Well, hey everyone! Welcome to episode 362 of S-Stop, Collaborate and Listen with your host, Matt Payne. This week on the podcast, I sat down and had a wonderful chat with one of the most highly revered UK photographers of our time, Paul Wakefield. Paul's book, The Landscape, is often referred to as one of the best contemporary landscape photography books available today. I can attest that his book is quite magnificent and worthy of such praise. When I found out that Paul had a new book coming out, I just had to find a way to get him on the show to talk about it. And so here we are. This week's conversation weaves in and out of many interesting topics, so sit back and enjoy the conversation. This week's podcast is brought to you by Nature Photographers Network. NPN is my favorite photography website. If you are looking to improve your skills as a nature photographer, NPN is where you should go. The feedback that you're able to access on the critique forums is better than anywhere else and much less expensive than you might expect. For just $49 per year, you can gain access to this amazing resource, which will surely improve your nature photography game. Just go to npn.link/fstop to join, and be sure to use the code FSTOP10 for your 10% discount. That's npn.link/FSTOP. Okay, let's get to this week's episode with Paul Wakefield.
All right, Paul Wakefield, it's great to have you on the show.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me, Matt.
Yeah, of course. I feel like your name has been recommended or mentioned about 300 times on this podcast, so it's pretty exciting for me to have you here in person, on camera. For people who aren't familiar with you and the type of photography that you do, why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Okay, well, I did a foundation course and a three-year photography course back in the early 70s and started working at college in the last year using the college studios to do jobs that I got commissioned for in London. And I would come back to Birmingham. I was in college in Birmingham. And I'd come back in Birmingham and use the college studios, because I didn't have a studio in London at the time, to complete the jobs. And there were things like book jackets, and then I started doing record covers and design work and stuff like that. And then later on in the, I guess, at the end of the course, I moved to London, where my girlfriend was. And I then, at the beginning of the 80s, I started really wanting more challenges in the commercial work. I mean, I was doing my own personal work as well at the same time, which was mostly landscape, which I'd partly been doing at college. And that was the reason I really got into photography to do landscapes. I then went into advertising, got agents in Paris, London, and New York. And yeah, the work is very challenging. It's kind of risky. There's no leeway for mistake, which I'm absolutely fine with. I mean, I kind of love the whole risk thing. I find it really exciting. And of course, the money is good too. And the group dynamic is fantastic, which I don't have in my own work, because all my own personal work is only ever done on my own, individually. I don't go with any assistants or any other photographers ever. So that's it, really.
So you've been a full-time photographer since... like probably right around the time when I was born.
When you were born, exactly.
Yeah. That's amazing. So I'm curious, you know, you started out monetizing your work by doing, like you say, risky kind of album covers and commercial work and advertising work. And you definitely mentioned that it was risky and there's no room for mistakes. How did that approach to photography trickle over into the way that you approached creating landscape images?
Well, the thing about making landscape photographs is you're dealing with something that's completely unpredictable. You know, I'm using natural light. I'm completely beholden to the conditions that I find in the landscape.
Right.
And so I guess I was used to not having things all my own way, like studio photographers would do. And probably that gave me a good balance of understanding, confidence, risk. I made a lot of mistakes. I still make a lot of mistakes. I don't have a problem with making mistakes. I think people maybe are a little bit too afraid of making mistakes, but actually you learn a lot more from your mistakes than you do from your successes. You don't learn a great deal from a picture that works, apart from the fact mm-hmm. that you finally made it work. Right. But you do learn a hell of a lot from mistakes. The thing is, you cannot make mistakes in commercial work, particularly in something like advertising, where you are out in the natural light with a team of maybe anywhere between 4 and 20 people. You cannot come back without the pictures. It's just a no-no. I mean, right. Your career will be over. So basically, it's all about having a really, really good team of people with you, which goes all the way through from the producer to your assistants to all the individual people you might have, set builders, animal wranglers, all sorts of people. And you basically have to have a very good group dynamic, and you have to be able to trust everybody, and you have to be able to give everybody their own space to do their own job with confidence. Mm-hmm. What you don't want on a commercial job is someone that's frightened or worried, because it'll dissipate into the group, and that's not a good thing. So okay. I try to give the people who I work with the responsibility and the confidence that they have, because otherwise I guess I probably wouldn't employ them, because I employ people on a freelance basis. By recommendation, my producer has a hell of a lot to do with it as far as the recommendation goes. She often gets all my people arranged for me, particularly in the States. I use a producer in the States and I use one in France. And so I guess I did have confidence quite early on from dealing with an unknown situation. And an unknown situation really is natural light outside. I mean, I can remember being on one of my first big jobs in America, and I turned up and the art director looked at me and said, "Great, you know, so where's your equipment?" And I said, "Well, it's in the back of the truck, you know," and he had a look in the back of the truck, and there was a camera bag and a tripod. And we were doing a car shoot outside in Monument Valley. And he said, "So where's the lighting truck?" And I said, "What are you?" I just put my hands up like that, and I just sort of looked up into the sky, and I thought, "It's there. It's up. It's all there." And it freaked me out a little bit, but we got through it. You also have to have. I learned to have backup very early on, and one of the things that you can do to help you with that, with location photography, is you know, as everybody knows, you can change the whole dynamic and look of an image by replacing the sky. I mean, you've got to do it carefully, you've got to do it well, but it's very easy to do. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I don't do in my own work, because I don't have any interest in doing it. I only do it if there's an issue with a job. And for example, if you're in a situation and the agency and the art director and everyone is expecting a certain thing, and you're not getting that kind of light, then you have to have something in your back pocket to calm them down a little bit. And basically, it's a 4x5 box of transparencies of skies. And when they start freaking out, you know, in the evening, saying, "Well, we're not getting the weather we want, you know, what are we going to do? What are we going to do?" And I just get a little light box out and I throw a few transparencies on the light box. And I said, "Well, you know, look, this will work, that'll work, this will work, you know, we can put..." And I actually cut 4x5 Polaroids together and make little mock-up prints for them. I used to do that. And everyone calms down a little bit. And I mean, I want a job to be enjoyable. I want it to be fun, but I also take it very, very seriously. But I don't want to go away on location and have a nerve-wracking time with a bunch of people who are freaking out all the time.
For sure,
Yeah.
So you spent a lot of time talking about how you made your living doing commercial work and advertising work. Was that your true passion, or was that just a means for putting food on the table?
Well, it was both, really. I mean, the thing is, I wanted to actually be a photographer.
Right. Any kind of photographer.
Well, not any kind of photography. No, I did a lot of studio photography in the first, up until about 1980. I did quite a lot of studio photography, record covers and things like that. And I learned about lighting, which is essential because you then learn about more about lighting when you go outside. But my big passion really was natural light outdoor photography. And yeah, it's a great way of making a living. But I wanted to actually be a photographer. I didn't want to be a hobbyist. You know, I didn't. And at that time, in the early 70s, the word workshop just did not exist. Mm-hmm. And also, I'm not a very good teacher. I didn't want to be a teacher. I don't like telling people what to do. Although I know people in workshops, they're not there to tell you what to do. They're there to give you sort of advice. I'm not really very good at that. I didn't like school. I don't really like authority of any kind. I like people to make their own decisions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for me, it's all about self-discovery.
Right.
That's why I'm very keen on maps and things like that. You know, I mean, I'm sure you're very keen on maps and stuff as well, coming from the area that you live in.
I love maps. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's how I find half of the photographs I've captured is I look at a map and I'm like, oh, that looks like a really interesting place. Let's go look at it.
Exactly, Matt. And you know, the thing is, you're not looking at someone else's photograph to make that decision for you.
No.
You're looking at a topographical diagram that actually, after a lot of practice, you can read as a visual book.
Absolutely.
You know, you can almost put yourself down on the ground and walk through it. Especially if it's a good, I mean, you have good topo maps there, and we have good topo maps here. And they're fantastic. They're full of detail. So, yeah, I learned through maps, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you've been making photographs for quite a long time. How has the industry changed for the better or worse since you began working in the field?
Well, it has changed a hell of a lot in all sorts of fields. I mean, certainly in the commercial field, it changed dramatically with the financial crash in 2008, when clients and account departments in agencies kind of grabbed the artistic content from the art department and basically told the art department what they should be doing and how much money they had. Whereas previously before, the art department would come up with an idea and give it to the accounts department and say, there you are, go and sell that to the client. I don't care how much it costs, just do it. And of course you got great work because the world was your oyster in a way, and the advertising industry in America was absolutely booming because of it, because they were open to all sorts of ideas. And during that financial crisis it almost completely disappeared over a period of about, I guess, 5 or 6 or 7 years. And then, of course, the other thing that happened was the digital era came in, and it became a lot easier for people to make pictures and become photographers.
Right.
And I certainly don't have anything against that. The more people that are visually educated, whether they do it themselves or through college or workshops, the better. But it did mean that there were a hell of a lot more people out there wanting jobs. And so the pool got very, very big, and the jobs got less and less and less, and you really had to be on your toes to keep going. That's what a competitive industry should be like, in a way.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, you've also got, with Instagram and all of that, then you have the boom of influencers, where basically there's people out there that, you know, they're willing to get paid almost nothing to promote a product. If they get it for free, or maybe they get like $1,000 and they share
it
to their huge fan base. And I'm sure lots and lots of companies are taking full advantage of that particular marketing scheme.
Yeah, no, exactly. And you know, there are photographers out there who have not been doing it as anything like as long as me, who are way, way better known than me in huge areas of the industry. And that's fine, because they came at it from a different angle and they've gone into it in a different part of the industry. It's perfectly it's perfectly fine. I mean, I don't have any issues with that at all. And so I only started doing Instagram about 2 years ago, I think. And I really started doing it to sort of get some sort of marketplace for this new book I've done, the India book I've done. I probably wouldn't have done it otherwise. But, you know, it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about this a lot on the show. I mean, Instagram and social media, lots of pros and cons to that. But I think if you're in the business of selling your work professionally in any capacity, it makes a lot of sense to have some sort of social media presence, if not only for the relationships that you can build with other professionals.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it can be a lonely business.
Especially in landscape.
Especially in landscape. And I mean, you know, like I say, I don't go with other photographers to do it. I just go on my own. So yeah, I think it's fantastic. I think everything is a plus.
Yeah. Well, I know we're going to spend a lot of time talking about your new book, which, by the way, thank you for sending that over. That is really fantastic, and we'll talk a lot about it. But before we do that, I wanted to talk about your book that you're a little bit more well-known for, which is a huge tome, The Landscape, which was published in 2014. And I've heard a lot of my contemporaries kind of talk about that book and the work that's in that book as kind of like one of the hallmarks of our time in terms of landscape photography and what people should aspire towards. How did that particular book come about?
Well, that wasn't my first book, by the way. I've done four books before that. I did four books in the 80s, and I did them with a writer called Jan Morris.
Okay.
Who was a very, very well-known, established travel writer. And she hated that term, travel writer. And she was a very interesting woman. She was originally a man. Hmm. And she was the first person in, I think maybe the first person in Europe to have a sex change. And she went to Casablanca to do it. And she's an amazing, sadly she died last year. But at a grand old age of something like 98 or something, or 96, I can't remember. So I did four books with her on Wales, the place, Scotland, Ireland, and a sort of interim one on Britain. And I did those throughout the 80s. And I kind of, I was also doing a lot of commercial work. I also, about 1982, I started going to India, and that continued on to about 2001. And I was also doing a lot of work. So the publisher, when I was doing those first four books, he got me to do a book every like 2 years. And I mean, at the end of that, I just got complete burnout.
That's a lot of work.
And so I didn't do any more landscapes for about 2 years. Hmm. And carried on with commercial work and carried on with going to India. And then I thought, you know, after that interim period, there was a big enough gap for me to get that sort of out of my system, and I started going back and making landscapes again. But I didn't do it in a planned way, and I didn't want to do it about any specific country. I wanted to say something more about the topographical qualities of landscape and how landscape connected, similar landscapes connected in completely different countries. And so, you know, there was this feeling for me of a whole sort of ribbon or a narrative going around the world where you could connect landscapes. Some people get it, some people don't, as far as the layout of the book goes, but that's fine. You get out of it exactly what you want. There's no rule book there. And then after a while, I don't know, when did it come out? 2014, didn't it? About 2012, I did a photographic trip to the White Desert in Egypt. Mm. And it was my last main sort of connection to make in the book. And that was a connection between the deserts in the sort of Four Corners area of the States, Utah, Arizona, Colorado, and New Mexico, with an area that's where very similar things are happening with sand, erosion, wind, water, but in a completely different part of the world. But there's a really interesting connection there.
Hmm.
So after I did that, I felt I had the right amount of work to, I guess, make the statement that I wanted to make. And then it took me about, a year to sequence them, because I had a lot more pictures than I ended up in the book. I mean, I think there's something like 75 pictures in the book, and I had to get it down from about 250, something like that.
Right, that's such a painful process.
It is, and you know, there were obviously lots of those classic things where there were pictures there that absolutely they were going to be in. There was no way they were going to be out, and of course they ended up being out.
Right.
Because you can't keep something in that doesn't have a connection with the rest of the book. Mm-hmm. It's going to stand out like a sore thumb. I think it's at those times when you need some critical assistance, when you need to put it in front of other people. And for me, that's my wife. She's a painter, and we've critiqued each other's work all the way through our careers.
Mm.
And we're honest, and if you like, a little bit brutal. But because we know each other so well, we don't take it personally.
Right.
It's all for the good of the work. And so, right. Yeah, it got to that stage where I did that, and then I had to find a couple of writers. So yeah, it all came together like that, really.
One of the things that I noticed about your book is just how big it is. It's
big.
Yeah, right. I mean,
compared
to your, let's see if I can do this. Compared to your, this comparison. Book, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's a comparison.
So, why did you decide to go with such a large size, and how did that impact your production costs?
Well, you know, to be honest, the production costs I didn't even consider.
Hmm.
I think if I work from that premise, I won't do the book that I really want.
Mm-hmm.
And so I only thought about the production costs when I got them. When the whole book was designed, I did it with a guy called Eddie Ephraims, who ran a very small imprint called Envisage Books. And he's a really, really, really great guy. And he's done a lot of short-run books with people, with photographers. And he's got a really good, he designed it. He's got a really good design sense. He's got a very, very good color management knowledge. And he's got very good contacts in the printing industry. And we use this printer in Italy called, EBS, which is quite amazing. And the paper is a wonderful paper. And the paper was made literally 20 miles down the road from the printers, which I loved. Mm-hmm. And it's FSC paper. So, you know, the whole thing was quite well locked in.
But I'm also guessing it affected shipping costs as well.
It sort of does. But you know, to be honest with you, when you're sending a small when I'm sending the India book or the landscape book to America by FedEx, it's exactly the same price.
Oh, okay, well, that's good.
It's not cheap. It's like $30, $35 to send a book from here to the States.
Right.
But you know, when you think of it, I mean, it's a meal for two people. In an okay restaurant, but that food, you know, you pass it out the next day, it's gone. But a book right. lasts forever. So you know that's why I don't really consider costs. I mean, books are so important, and they feed you for decades. A good book will feed you for decades. A meal will feed you for an evening. And I guess one of the reasons why I chose that size was, you know, I came from an era when photographers were doing monographs. And, you know, if you look at all the Sierra Club books, do you know the Sierra Club books?
Yeah.
The large format ones, they're that size.
Right.
And I guess that's what I wanted to do, and so I did.
I mean, that's a perfectly legit answer.
it's kind of like a portfolio. Do you know what I mean?
It's a bit like
handing somebody a book of prints in a way. But yeah, I mean, it wasn't It wasn't a dreadful amount to print. It really wasn't.
How many did you end up making?
We printed 1,000.
1,000. And it's just now almost sold out, right?
Yeah. And so we have. I haven't sold it through Amazon or anything like that.
Yeah,
and,
no, I think it's like, it's an interesting tale, right? I mean, you produced 1,000 copies a decade ago, and it's just now almost sold out. So for me, it's like just a bit of information for other people who might be looking to do their own book that there's a chance that you might not sell it out for a decade or more. So like, just keep that in mind.
Yeah. And there's no big deal on that. I mean, but you know, if you went to a main publisher, they look at a book as having a shelf life of a year or two max.
Mm-hmm.
And then if it's not sold, they'll remainder it. Now, those first four books that I made, or that I published through a publisher called Warren Press, they printed 10 and 15,000 copies.
Mm-hmm.
And they all sold really quickly. There was no internet then.
Right.
You had to buy, if you wanted to see something, if you wanted to know about someone's work, you had to buy a book. And so they were all over bookshops. Very, very difficult to get your book in a bookshop now.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so it's great that you can actually, a lot of people self-publish, and that's a great way of, loads of photo books now are self-published. And, you know, like I said, some of the guys that are much newer to the photographing industry than me, they'll do a book and they'll pre-sell it out on Instagram before they even receive it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, fantastic.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a good.
I wish I could do that, but I can't. I'm kind of like the tradition of slow food, really. You know, I come from an area of slow food, and so I'm a slow photographer.
I love that. Well, so I would say that the images in your 2014 book embody a very personal and unique style of seeing. I've had a lot of photographers on my podcast talk about your photography as being something that they aspire to. How did you develop that style or vision, if you will, for your particular work? What's the secret there?
Well, you know, it's a $64 million question, really. But there is, I have to say, there is no secret. What I mean, I'll try to explain it as well as I can in the only process, if you like, that I followed. And, you know, I took my first photographs when I was about 12 with my father's Zeiss Contiflex, and they were complete, as you can imagine.
Yes.
I was a 12-year-old. He didn't tell me how to use the camera. So I went out and I photographed a troop of monkeys down the end of our road in Hong Kong, where I was born. And the little lovely little box of yellow Kodachromes came back. There was nothing on there. There was just like a few blurry branches and leaves. And I thought, well, I'm sure I saw the monkeys through the viewfinder, you know. And anyway, so I tried again, absolutely hopeless. So I put it away. And then I was sent to school in UK, which was a complete disaster for me. You know, I was taken away from a place I loved. And I sort of compensated for that by spending all the time that I possibly could in the school library that had National Geographic and Life magazine and all the back numbers.
Hmm.
And so I used that as a sort of form of escapism. And then I started to use it as, if you like, a form of sort of self-education.
Mm-hmm.
Because what I was really intrigued about why I'd failed. And I was looking at all these absolutely amazing photographs and thinking, well, why did that work? Why did they work? And so I sort of started to deconstruct images. And you know, you put little bits of card over, you put your hand over, and you think, well, if I take that bit out, oh yeah, it doesn't work. Take that bit out, it doesn't work. Everything, in a good photograph, everything has to be there.
Mm.
However insignificant it might seem to be. And so, I don't know, maybe, and I had no camera at all at school. I had no camera. And there was no art class, so I wasn't even doing art. And so, I don't know, I sort of somehow imbibed a way of looking in an incredibly personal, relaxed way without any instruction. And maybe that's it. I don't know.
Well, as you were talking about that process, what kept coming to my mind is that you were developing visual literacy, right? You were looking at lots and lots and lots of images, figuring out why those images worked and why you had a preference for certain images over other ones. And in a way, you're just kind of filing that away in your brain, like, okay, this works, that doesn't work. This is what I like, this is what I don't like. And then when you're in the field with a camera, I mean, even if it's 10, 15, 20 years later, that stuff's going to resurface and it's going to become very useful in terms of developing and honing in your own way of seeing the world through the camera.
Well, there you go. I mean, that's you've explained it a lot better than I have. And that's exactly, no, honestly, Matt, that is exactly probably what I was doing. I guess that is what I was doing. And so, you know, when I then left school, I was intending to go to become a sort of possibly a research scientist. I was very interested in nature, and I was a scuba diver, which I'd learned to do in Hong Kong. And I thought, well, I'd be a marine biologist. And then after I left school, I literally did a 180-degree turn and went to art college and never looked back. And got my dad's camera. He gave me that camera that I used. He gave it to me. And I think you're right in what you said a minute ago. When I got to college with a camera, I started taking photographs that I'd been thinking about but not being able to do. Mm-hmm. And I was able to take pretty good pictures almost instantly.
What role would you say intention plays in how you make photographs?
Well, it's a really interesting word, intention, because you can take it in so many different directions. I can only look at my own work and my the taking of photographs in a completely subjective manner. I don't look at it in an objective manner at all. I look at it I come from an emotional standpoint. And I think that every piece of creative work that any kind of artist does, whether it's a painter, a musician, a writer, a sculptor, a potter, a photographer, you know, everything is a sort of an act of love, really. You know, every little picture. I suppose there's that. And then, you know, when I'm out in the field, out in the landscape, I mean, I do literally physically love the landscape, almost in a slightly bizarre way. Probably best not too much said about that. You know, I'll be walking along and I'll pass something, and it's generally something that I've seen out of the corner of my eye. And I flashed by it. And I think, oh, what was that, you know? And I'll stop and sort of go and investigate. And I use a 4x5 Linhof viewer as my viewing tool. And that's in my pocket. And my 4x5 camera is on my back in a pack with a tripod. And I'll go back and I'll try and find what I saw. And if I can see there's something of interest there, I'll take everything off. I don't mean my clothes. That's not the thing I'm talking about being weird about. I'll take my pack, put my pack down, put my tripod down, and really, really, really focus in with this little viewer. And I'll get myself into what I believe is the only position that will make a good picture. It's literally not 1 centimeter here, not 1 centimeter there, back or forth only. It's literally this absolute pinpoint spot. And it's a little bit like a load of cogs coming together in alignment, and they click and clunk in place. And it just kind of, a kind of almost like a theatrical curtain opens up in front of you. And I know this is not, it's a bit of a weird way to describe it, but you know what I mean? Something is revealed to me that I thought I saw, and there it is. And what I want to do is I want to pass on what I saw or what I see in the best way that I can for others to see.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I set my, I put my, my viewer on the ground. I set my tripod up over the viewer and I put my chin on the plate of the tripod because my chin to my eye almost exactly the same distance from my flatbed of the ebony camera to the 120 axis of the lens. And then I'll do a little, you know, jiggery pokery, get it exact, put the dark cloth oven, and then hope for the light.
Right.
But the composition for me is the main thing. If I haven't got a composition, I've got, not got a picture. I don't take pictures of light just for the sole purpose of taking a picture of light.
Right.
That's not to say the light's not important. If, of course, it's extremely important. But as you can see from my pictures, I take light in very, very soft, yep. very slightly... Oh, what's this? Slightly melancholic conditions. Maybe that's my personality. That's my nature. I don't know. But I like soft light because the thing is, once I've got a really good composition, the one thing that can completely break that composition is the wrong kind of light. If it's really brash and really hard and really sharp, it's just going to clash everything and you're not going to see my composition. It's all going to break up. So...
Right, unless the composition is about the light, right?
But that's... Absolutely, absolutely. And if the composition is about the light, absolutely fine.
Right.
I tend not to work that way.
Yeah. No, it's interesting as you were talking about kind of your approach there in terms of, oh, something caught my attention. Now I have to find the exact spot and all the cogs are moving and boom, it's locked in. I was kind of reminded of a critiquing session that Tim and I did yesterday for our competition. And there was a few images that we were looking at where I found myself trying to figure out what wasn't working about the photograph for me as the viewer. And I was reminded of that process of, okay, as the photographer, your job is to distill down what you loved about what you're photographing and what caught your interest initially and distill that down into a way that conveys it immediately and succinctly and effectively to the viewer. And in the particular image that I was looking at, it just wasn't working in that particular way. So we were cropping and trying to figure out a way to do that until it revealed itself. And we finally figured out, okay, this is probably what the photographer saw and noticed. And so, but they just didn't quite hit the mark in terms of, you know, like you're saying, all the cogs working themselves into place to reveal the precise display of what they noticed and do it in a way that conveyed what they saw very well.
Yes. I mean, maybe that's a case of somebody, you know, finalizing their composition before they really had got to the end of it.
Mm, yeah.
It can easily be that. And the only way I think you can know about that is to keep going.
Right.
Is to really keep going and ask yourself, is this the best it can be? And I'm lucky in that I do ultimately get this feeling of everything interlocking. And if I don't, I know it's not going to work and I walk away.
Mm.
Sometimes if I'm not, it's quite rare that I'm not sure. And sometimes if I'm not sure, I will take it. And of course, those are the mistakes. And sometimes even the good ones are the mistakes. And with 4x5 film, you know, there's not many mistakes you can make because it's quite expensive. And, you know, I only carry enough film with me during a day to maybe make 10 images.
Sure.
So I've got to do my editing at the time I'm making my pictures.
Right.
I can't take tons and tons of pictures and then edit them back at the studio later on. Well, I can, but I would have to use a digital camera for that.
Right.
And yeah, maybe I will, but I do like the whole process of making that decision at the time of seeing it. I think it's that whole risk thing again, really, I like, but that I like, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and it forces you to... really dial it in and make sure that what you're pressing the shutter on is exactly the way that you want it to be as the end result. I mean, of course you can take a 4x5 sheet of film, get it drum scanned, you know, edit it in Photoshop, crop, whatever. You can do all that stuff too, but it seems to me like that is what makes large format film or medium format film so interesting and challenging, is that you have to be a really, really good curator of your images in the moment.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. Yeah. I mean, I really don't think I crop at all afterwards. In fact, there's one image in the landscape book. It's of a shot of a close-up bit of rock in Glen Nevis. And it's not an iconic shot or anything like that, but it's a really nice image, and it worked very well in the narrative of the book. But when I came to look at it as a larger print in the context of the book, I suddenly realized it hadn't worked, and I couldn't understand why, because I'd seen that it worked on the contact.
Mm-hmm.
On the contact sheet. And so I went and I thought, it's not the same at all. And I thought, well, it is. It's there. I mean, I just printed it. So I went back and I looked really, really carefully at what I'd done. And I had mistakenly cropped out about a centimeter, or not even that, half a centimeter on the right-hand side of the image. And that half centimeter on the right-hand side, nobody would have noticed. But to me, the whole composition fell apart.
Mm.
And I did actually use that image as an example of how important framing is in a workshop once. And I made two prints actually. I made two prints, one with the piece in and one with the piece out. And I kind of asked people which one they thought was best. And they all thought the one without the crop was best, but they didn't know why. And it's because that half centimeter on the right-hand side was so unbelievably important.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting how even a small crop like that can have such a profound impact on the final result of an image. I'm curious, in your opinion, what do you think are the qualities of a good landscape photograph? Or maybe let's take it a step further, a great landscape photograph. So I think a good landscape photograph is fairly easy to... I think a good landscape image is relatively easy to accomplish, but a great photograph, that's like next level for me.
Yeah. And again, the thing about that is it's entirely subjective. You might look at an image and think it's great, and I might look at it and think it's okay.
Yes, yes.
and that's as it should be. I think... If you can get the quality into your photograph, the emotional quality into your photograph of how you were feeling at the time that you were looking at what you were photographing, if you can get that into your photograph, then it's my opinion that other people will see it too.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how you do that. There's not a trick. There's not a set of rules. And I'm not being obtuse here. If I knew what it was, I'd bottle it and sell it. But I don't know what it is. I think honesty is a huge thing.
Hmm.
I think honesty is very, very important. I think, God, I don't know. What do you think?
I have lots of thoughts, but before I give, what do you mean by honesty? Because that's kind of a loaded term.
What do I mean by honesty? I don't know, really. I know what I mean by it, but I don't know of a clear enough way to explain it.
Are you able to explain the opposite, like an image that isn't honest? Like, what are we being honest about? Like, are you being honest about what you actually experienced and captured? Are you being honest about?
No. I don't mean that at all. No, I don't mean that. But I'm not talking about the. I think I'm talking about being honest to yourself.
Mm.
And that's what I'm talking about. Being honest to yourself. I'm not talking about whether you've been fiddling around with the image afterwards or you've been putting a sky. And I'm not talking about that at all. That's a completely different subject matter. I'm talking about whether you're being honest with yourself or whether you're trying to convince yourself this is a good image when actually you know it really isn't.
Haha.
And I think that is being super, super critical with yourself and being really assiduous and being really taking the greatest amount of care you possibly can and putting in the greatest amount of dedication you possibly can to each individual image. And I think that's possibly why I don't actually take that many pictures, because I walk away from a lot instead of making them.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't arise to what I feel is the criteria of a good image. And it's for other people to judge whether it's a great image or not, or even a good image or not. I kind of feel if I know I've done a good image, and that's all I can do. I mean, I don't make photographs for other people. And I think that is also an incredibly important thing for people to consider when they're working, that they should only make photographs for themselves. And hope, or whether it's whether you hope or whatever, I mean, whether people like my pictures or not is an entirely different subjective matter for them. It's great if people do, but I'm not going to lose sleep over it.
Right.
Because I like them. And that's what, and I'm the person I made them for. But I don't want to keep them in a drawer and not show them to anybody. What's the point of that?
Right.
And I'm perfectly happy for other people not to like them, because it's a totally subjective thing. Mm-hmm. I don't like a lot of stuff that loads of other people like. So I don't know. I think that's what I mean by honesty. That I think you have to be honest with yourself. And I think if you are honest with yourself, I think you will work harder. I think you will look closer. I think you will be more critical and more decisive. And all of those things, I think, will help make better pictures. I don't know.
No, I think that's right on. To answer the question that you threw back at me, what I think makes a good or a great landscape photograph, the first thing I'm always looking for is, and again, this is a really kind of subjective and a little woo-woo, I guess, or hard to pin down, but can I tell that the photographer brought something of themselves to the table in terms of capturing the image, whether that be showcasing something that they're passionate about or that they're very interested in, or doing it in a way or in a style that is unique to them or the way that they see the world. I'm always looking for that angle in a photograph. Similar to you, I'm always trying to piece together what kind of emotion might be trying to be conveyed through the image, especially if it's an emotion that person experienced while capturing it. Or maybe the next best thing is, what emotion is the image trying to be an equivalent to? I'm also looking for metaphors in photographs. I think metaphors are really interesting and fun.
Yeah.
I'm looking for a style. Like if someone has a style that's recognizable, I'm really drawn to those types of photographs where I'm like, oh, that's a Paul Wakefield image. I can just tell. Like, you know, that's, to me, that's important. And again, sort of hard to put your finger on that as well.
Yeah.
And then kind of going back to my first thing about bringing something of themselves to the table, if it's like of a very recognizable composition of a location that's been photographed before, it's really, really hard for me to connect with that particular image as a consumer of photography, just because I don't feel like the photographer needed to do a lot in terms of bringing any part of themselves to the equation. It still might be a beautiful image. It still might convey emotion. It still might convey beauty. It still might represent a beautiful experience, whatever. But as a person who looks at a lot of photographs, I want to see stuff that's different, interesting, unique, creative. So I'm looking for those things. Yeah. Does any of that resonate with you?
Mm-hmm. All of it does. I mean, all of it does. I think... Yeah, all of it does. I mean, I think one of the things that I do try to do, you know, the first year that I was at foundation course, where you're not doing necessarily photography, you're doing everything to do with art, and we had an art history class, and I didn't know a great deal about art history at the time, and I was introduced to paintings and all sorts of things, and sometimes you latch onto something. You see something and you think, that's how I feel. And it happened to me in that art history class. We had an amazing teacher. He was a fantastic guy. He was talking about a painter called Caspar David Friedrich. And he flashed up this image in the talk on the projection screen. And it's this painting called, I think it's called Wanderer in a Sea of Fog, I think, or mist. And it's kind of unique in the art world, I think. I can't think of another example. And what it is a painting of a man standing right in the front, but he's got his back to you. You're looking at his back. And so you're looking at his back and you're looking at the scene that he's looking at. And it's a melancholic picture, which kind of is me as well. I mean, my style is melancholic. And I looked at this picture and I thought, that's what I want to do. I want to give people that feeling of what it's like to stand in front of a picture and put themselves in that picture and be able to walk around. And so that's why, for me, the framing, the edges are so important. And what I went back to with that little sliver down the side there, and that what's outside of the image is almost as important as what's inside the image, and that what you're making a photograph of should give you some sort of really strong feeling of what the whole scene is, and that you can. I want people to be able to step over the frame threshold and walk about and turn around and have a look back at themselves. I mean, it's a bizarre thing to say, and it might, and people are probably, you know, saying, what a idiot that guy is. I don't know. But I do it. That's what I do. And I think it goes back to that whole thing I was doing of deconstruction and things like that. And I still do it now with other people's pictures. When I look at other people's pictures, and I do all the time, I go through a whole little quick thing, almost without even thinking about it. Is this a good picture? And all those criteria go through. And I think a great picture will stand up to all of that critical look.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll come back out of the picture and you say, yeah, it's fantastic.
I love it. All right, Paul. I'd love to talk to you about your latest book, Indian Rites, Signs of Devotion. I was pretty amazed when I realized that all of the images from the book were captured across a long span of time in the past, ranging from about 1984 through 2001. And so I guess my first question I had for you is, why did it take you so long to publish these incredible photographs?
I do work in a slow way. I don't like to rush things. I also think there's a right time to do something. Having said that, I did try to publish this book twice before,
mm-hmm.
In the mid-90s and then in the late 90s. Mm-hmm. And at both times, a publisher had it for about a year.
Mm-hmm.
And both times I thought it would happen. Neither time it didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
But that was okay. And then I got very, very busy commercially. And I had a dummy that we'd made, and then I met somebody. I met somebody that I knew when I was working in India, who is the guy that I ultimately published it with. I met him at the memorial of the woman who I dedicated that book to, an Australian photographer called Robin Beach, who I met in London when she was working as an incredibly innovative fashion photographer. And she moved to India because she went there on a trip in about the mid-80s And she was so struck by it, and she met the right people, and she moved and lived in an ashram, and she converted to being a Hindu, something that I wouldn't do, I couldn't do. But she was unbelievably dedicated, and it kind of rubbed off on me, really, a little bit, that whole thing of dedication, and about how important it is to get something right. And I think that's probably why it took me quite a long time to do that landscape book. Having done four books in quite a short space of time, I did four books in 8 years, I realized I didn't regret anything about that. I mean, I thought it was okay. I mean, they were fine. I mean, I stand by them. But I realized that to do something, you know, really special, it takes some time. And then I met Navneet in 2017 in London at Robin's memorial. She died of cancer. He said to me, "Oh, whatever happened to all those pictures that you and Robin..." Well, not me, but Robin was taking pictures as well. We used to go together. And I said, "Oh, you know, I've got them in a dummy and blah, 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 blah." And he said, "Oh, look, I'm here in London for a week." He lives in India, in Varanasi. "Come, show me what you got." And so I brought the dummy up to London, and he was completely... He just said, "We've got to do this, you know, we've got to publish this book." And he also has a gallery in Varanasi that shows fine art, miniatures, Indian miniatures, photography, all sorts of things. And I said, "Yeah, great, fine. Okay, we'll do it." And so, yeah, it took us from about 2017, and then the pandemic got in the way. So, I mean, I guess the book would have come out, if the pandemic hadn't got in the way, the book would probably have come out in about 2020. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it's okay. But it did allow, and also it allowed me to get a couple of what I think of were really good essays, which I was very, very happy about.
I think having really good writing in a photography book that ties together what the photographs are about is really important. I find that's often what's missing from a lot of people's photography books, is that they just put together a bunch of photographs, but then they don't incorporate any narrative or anything that helps to support the story or to help help guide the experience of experiencing the book. And so yeah. I really appreciate when there's good writing in a book such as that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, a lot of photo books, in my opinion, I mean, are great photographically, but quite exactly as you say, there's no sort of guideline along the way to sort of point about why they're doing this book, what's the point of it. And the thing is, I like getting involved with writers that aren't necessarily knowledgeable about photography. Yeah. Because they bring something else entirely new to the story. I mean, in the landscape book, Robert McFarlane is the most amazing writer about landscape. And you know, when he opened his piece using that quote from Cormac McCarthy, "Blood Meridian," I mean, Cormac McCarthy is like a god to me. You know, I mean, yeah, God Almighty. And when I read that, and he sent it to me by email, and I read that, I said, "Oh my God, I've struck gold here." You know, how good could it be? And so that was fantastic. And again, the other man, Andrew Wilton, he is the Tate expert on J.W.M. Turner. You know, again, a painter who I think is wonderful, and neither of them knew much about photography, but they can understand what they're looking at, and they can bring something to the work that a person who knows about photography couldn't, in my opinion. Right. So that's the way I go about it, really.
I love it. So given the large span of time that this work embodies, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on how somebody else looking to make a book would know if they have enough high quality work to make a book of this caliber.
Well, it's a gut reaction, I think, really. I mean, you've got to stop at some point. Uh-huh. with both books, of course, I could have gone on and on and on. But there's a limit, of course, in a book of how many pictures you can put in. Otherwise, it's going to get boring.
Is there a sweet spot, do you think?
I reckon about 75 pitches is about all you need. And if you need more pitches to tell the narrative that you're trying to get across, then something's not working. Because I think there's a certain attention span that you can hold, and then you go beyond it mm-hmm. with your viewer. And then if it's a lot less, people are left thinking, yeah, but where's the rest?
Really?
So I think 75 pitches is about right. And I mean, when I look at a lot of books, that's a pretty good number. You know, and again, it's a gut reaction. I mean, people will know when they've done it and when they've not. And also they can, you know, they can show it to other people, see what they think, and get a lot of... It's very, very important to get some sort of critique on your work. Really, really important. I can't stress absolutely. The importance of that. Otherwise, you're working in a vacuum, really.
Right. Everything's amazing. Exactly. I mean, that's my problem.
And you've left in those pictures that you really, really were going to include but should take out.
Right. I recently spent 3 weeks in Antarctica and came home with, you know, like a ridiculous number of photographs that, you know, obviously I didn't like all of them, but I had a huge number of photographs to go through. And I distilled it down to about 130 images that I liked. And then I sent it to like four people that I trust and admire. And I said, okay, which ones need to stay? Which ones need to go? And there was quite a bit of overlap in terms of what people thought should go. And so I was like, yep, if four people agree that these should go, then those should go. And so that was kind of my process of like, okay, I can only get it down this far. I need some help.
And actually, it's a lot easier being critical like that with someone else's work than with your own. It's very, very difficult to do with my work.
So much easier. It's like, I can do it all day long with other people's photos, but with my photos, I've just completely lost all objectivity. I mean, it's just out the window.
I mean, you know, a good way of practicing is going to books that you like and going through and thinking, how many of these pictures really need to be in this book? Mm-hmm. And if it's a good book, all of them. It doesn't necessarily mean to say that you like all of them, because there's flow and pace that are important, but every one of them should need to be there to form the narrative that photographer is trying to make.
Right.
So I would say that a good book, all the pictures should be there.
Makes sense.
And they should count.
Yeah. So it's funny because before we recorded, we were talking about how you don't like to apply labels to yourself in terms of, oh, I'm a landscape photographer, I'm a commercial photographer, I'm a street photographer. And so it was interesting for me kind of knowing you as a landscape photographer, just because that's what I'm into is mostly landscapes. And so getting your book and seeing it's kind of more of a street / culture / travel photography genre, it was interesting for me to think about how the images were impacted in terms of composition and selection because of your predilection for making fantastic landscape images. So I'm curious to hear you talk a little bit about how your skills as a landscape photographer translated into your approach to making the images for the Indian Rights book.
Well, I think it comes down to that thing that I said about being in the right being on the right spot, and that's if you like, that's easier to do. Well, not necessarily easier to do, but I know I'm much better at doing it than with landscape than I was with doing it street photography. Mm. Street photography, landscape doesn't move. I mean, all right, it moves. I mean, the wind comes and blah blah blah. But it's there. It's solid. It doesn't move.
Right.
Street photography, it's constantly on the move.
Right.
But there is still a place to stand. There is still a spot to stand on. And I realized that, and I think I probably realized that by looking at, you know, when I went to India, I actually went in 1982. The two pictures in the book that say 1984, it's my mistake.
Oh.
It's actually 82. I didn't look at my diaries carefully enough. So even I can be sloppy.
That sounds like something I would do.
Yeah, right. So, and I went with my 4x5 camera. Well, what a daft thing to bloody do, you know. I went with the intention. I mean, Paul Strand is a huge, huge influence on me. I just love his work. And the photographs of the people that I did in my first four books, I used him as a template. And I took my 4x5 camera to India, intending to be influenced by Paul Strand and to try and make images by Paul Strand. And one of the pictures that is in the book is the one of the woman. I'm not sure what page it's in. It's the one with the woman and her grandson at the door of their house, and it's on page, I think, one something. Oh no, it's on page 86. And if you know Paul Strand's work, that's a pretty decent copy of Paul Strand's work. You know, he uses doorways. Yeah, this one here on the right. He uses doorways a lot, and his structure is very much like that. And so that's a complete and absolute nod to him. Total hat tip to him. But I realized what was happening. That was fine because I set that up. That was a portrait. But what I was actually looking at was this incredibly fast moving world where things were happening that I didn't understand. And a 4x5 was not going to cut it. And so I came back from that trip having made a number of fairly good pictures. I mean, two are in the book. And I thought, what can I do here? You know, I really want to go back. I wanna make pictures of all those things that I saw, but I need to change what I'm doing. And at that time, in 1984, there was an exhibition at the Hayward Gallery in London of a guy called Joseph Kodelka. He's probably about 86 now, and it's hard to describe what he does, but you could say he's a street photographer. He's all black and white. His pictures are absolutely stunning. I saw that exhibition and I looked at it and I thought, that's what I need to be doing in India. And he had this little book. They were selling this little book at the gallery. It's the first book I think he published when he must have been, I don't know, in his 40s. And it's a little French book called Photo Poche. And it became a series that the French publisher did using lots of different people. And I said, yeah, I thought, yeah, that's it. That's what I need to be doing. And so I looked and looked and looked at that pitch, that photographic book. And I went, you know, he used a Leica, an old Leica. So I went out and I bought an M6. And I bought with one lens, an M6 with a 35mm lens, and I bought a 6x9 Fuji camera with a fixed 65mm lens. And both of those are the same ratio aspect that my 4x5 with my 120 lens in is. I keep it simple. I basically keep it simple. I mean, when I go in the landscape, I have maybe one or two other lenses just in case. In case I can't get what I need and I need to use a little slightly wide angle lens. But basically it's the 120. And basically in India, that's all I had. I had a 35mm lens on a 35mm camera, and I had a 65mm lens on a 6x9 camera, and I used colour negative. And that's what I did. And I went back and I thought, that's the only way I'm going to be able to make pictures of those really, really fleeting things that I'm looking at that I don't understand. And they were mostly, I realized after a while, things to do with everyday rituals that people were carrying out to do with partly to do with their religion. And the reason I didn't know what was going on was because their religion is a complete mystery to me. And it's mostly Hinduism, but there's Jainism, there's Buddhism, there's Muslim, but it's mostly, the majority of what you see is Hinduism. And it's being carried out as a matter of course, as important as drinking a glass of water, going to bed at night. It's part of their everyday life. It's not separated. And it was something completely new to me. I'd never seen such dedication. And the other thing as well is I like ritual. You know, when I go out into the landscape, I'm performing a little ritual. You know, I have a process. I stick to it. I feel I'm in my comfort zone. And so I kind of understood what they were doing in a completely different way, but I didn't know what they were doing and I didn't know why they were doing it. And so I basically wanted to learn more. And I thought the way to find out more was to find a place in the street where I perceived that things would happen and that the juxtaposition of people passing and things to do with that were already there in the street to do with the religion, whether it was a temple doorway or whether it was a tiny little god painted on the side, a symbol of a god painted on the side of a corner, anything that would give me some pivot that the people would swing around and then they would bounce off and I would just stand there and it would take about maybe 15 or 20 minutes for people to take me for as a piece of the street scene, because of course I'm a foreigner. You know, I'm a foreigner. I'm wearing different clothes to them. I tried my hardest to fit in. So I didn't wear loud stuff, and I didn't have lots of expensive looking stuff. I just had my camera on my shoulder. I kept it really, really simple. And then after a while, they get bored and they carry on with their life. And then I can start looking, and then I can start waiting for things to happen. And things do happen. It's the most amazing thing. These pictures, they're kind of given to you. You know, they're sort of, they create themselves in front of you. It's like little theatre settings. And lots of times they work and lots of times they don't.
It seems like... curiosity about the religion and the rituals and the people there is really one of the most crucial aspects of what made your photography successful.
I think so. I mean, I think, you know, anyone who's curious, and I think I am really, really curious. Yeah, they're gonna try and find out what's going on. They're gonna try and make good pictures. I mean, I can't draw. I can't paint. I'm lucky that a mechanical piece of equipment like a camera was invented to express myself through. So, and you know, I would see things, like, you know, for example, on page 17, there's a photograph. It's of a man casting water from a pitcher, little brass pitcher tub. You know, if you take that man out of the picture, it's a pretty interesting image.
Right.
You know, a cow tethered in an alcove, which actually is a little mini temple. Inside that alcove is a yoni and a lingam, which is the male and the female sexual parts that are the both stone, and they're worshipped, and they're revered. And inside that, behind that cow, is this little sculpture of those two things, and beside it you have a statue of Hanuman having a fight with the devil. And that sculpture is not what you think it is. It looks more sexual than it actually is. It's not a sexual sculpture. That the thing that the what looks like if you it, what looks like the penis of the devil going up into Hanuman the god is not. It is Hanuman's loincloth hanging down over the devil. But that sort of juxtaposition and that uncertainty and that bizarre, is it this, is it that? And also, Hanuman is nearly always painted or carved fighting a devil. And so this very, if you like, violent piece of work next to this really delicate calf, I thought, gosh, that's gonna make a really good picture, and I made a picture of it. And I thought, oh, it's really boring. And then as I was thinking that, this guy walked in front of me. And before I knew it, he'd pitched this little flask of water to this calf, and it landed in the sand. And the calf went to lick it, and there was nothing there. But it was the gesture that was important to him.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at, and the way he did it in this really, really nonchalant manner, I thought, that guy does that every morning. And so I looked at my watch, and I came down the next morning, and I came down half an hour earlier, and I walked along the ghats. This is in Varanasi. And I walked along the ghats, which is the huge, great stone steps that go down to the river where people do their morning worship and ablutions. And there he was. He was 100, 150 yards down the river doing his business. And so I went back and I thought, where do I need to stand? I've only got one chance. I've got one frame. I've got two cameras. I've decided which one to use. I've decided to use the more difficult one, 6x9, because I wanted the best quality I possibly could get. And he came by and I had my back to him. And he came by, and as he came by, I swung around, lifted the camera, and clicked the shutter. And I was lucky enough to get that. And the thing about both of those cameras is they're rangefinder cameras.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm looking through the rangefinder with my right eye, and my left eye is kind of free to check things out. You don't get that when you've got a central vision, a viewfinder in a central camera. Your left eye is blocked by the camera body. But my left eye is kind of there, and I kind of saw this thing happening. And I must have. It's a sort of subconscious thing. Anyway, that's what happened. And afterwards I thought, did I see that, or did I actually manage to get it on film? And I thought, I got it on film. I thought, well, I think I got it on film. So I thought, well, I can always go back the next morning and try again. And I thought, why bother? You know. There's that whole thing of anticipation, planning, care, dedication. Yeah, I don't know. It's all there, really. It's anything to do with making a creative piece of work. People will have that work ethic to put in, really.
What I thought was really interesting as I was going through your book, again, as a landscape photographer, is that I felt like you paid a lot of attention and close detail to composition and various compositional elements that helped to tell the story that you were trying to convey. You know, you have, like you were just talking about, you captured these daily moments that you were witnessing, which I feel like that kind of embodies the essence of street photography, like telling these stories and showcasing metaphor and things like that. But I felt like maybe because of your landscape background, or maybe just because of your commercial background, whatever the reason, I felt like above and beyond what I normally expect from street photography, you were paying a lot of attention to those compositional details that really helped to kind of lay the foundation for the photographs.
Yeah, I absolutely was. You're absolutely right about that. And you know, the interesting thing about that is, because I wasn't able to control the scene like I could when I make landscapes, in that the landscape, like I said, isn't moving. I thought, if anything is in the photograph that I don't like, I'll just crop it out. And you know, when I got back and I had a lot of those images printed up, I did exactly that. I cropped out quite a lot of some of those pictures.
Hmm.
And do you know something? Every single image in that book is uncropped.
Oh, wow.
Because I went back and looked at them again at a later stage, and I thought, what the hell are you doing cropping that vital bit of information out?
Hmm.
And what I was trying to do later on was to put it at a level of compositional perfection, control, not perfection, control, that I had with my landscapes, completely negating the whole point of being of documenting documenting something that was actually real, living and moving, and how important it was to keep it as it is. And so, yeah, every single image, I went back to the full frame of the image and had a look at that and how I cropped it and thought, well, what was I doing?
What do you hope that the book accomplishes? What are you hoping people take away from it? What are your goals with it? Tell me a little bit about your intention.
Well, I'd like it to sell.
Obviously, right?
Obviously. Well, I don't know, Matt. You know, I mean, I hope people get something personal out of it. I hope it might encourage them to look at something in a different way. You know, when you look at those two books and you see how different they are, but actually they're not that different. One is topographical landscape, one is human landscape. Mm-hmm. I personally think, and I you would you know it'd be really silly of me, I suppose, not to say this, because it's me saying it, and it's me seeing it, and me feeling it, and me taking the pictures, but they look like the same person to me. And I hope they do. I hope they do to other people, because maybe if they don't, maybe I've failed a bit. I don't know. I mean, do you think they look like the same person? I don't know. You tell me.
Oh, I think so, for sure. And the thing that I got out of it was, you have all of these relatively mundane moments in terms of they happen a lot in that environment, but you are able to capture them in a way that invites the viewer to be more curious, not only about places they visit, but maybe be more curious about things that are close to home, or maybe be more curious about other landscapes that you're visiting, whether that be in the forest or in the mountains or on the ocean or at the beach, whatever. I think for me, it's a great lesson in leveraging that curiosity, being patient, and then having more of a two-way conversation with your subject to reveal something about it.
Yeah, and I think that all of that is absolutely dead on, dead right. God, I don't know.
I think it's interesting, right? I mean, you have this book that, you know, most of the listeners of this show are nature and landscape photographers. Maybe they dabble in other genres of photography as well. But I've always been a strong believer that one of the most effective ways to become a better photographer, a better artist, a better human, is to study other art forms, to study other types of photography. And I think, and you're, you know, looking for commonalities, looking for things that you can incorporate into your own workflow, or how you see the world as a person. And so, if nothing else, I think it's a great way for other photographers to enrich their lives from that perspective.
Oh, you're absolutely right, man. I mean, it's one of the best things you can do is to look at things that you don't do. It's so important. I mean, that's why. I mean, I have a huge, huge library of books. Photography books, art books, books that people have written. I would say that I get a lot more out of photographic books that are not landscape than I do out of photographic books that are landscape. Because I'm so close to the subject, and I don't know what it is about. I don't want to sound arrogant or anything here, because I don't believe I am, but I know a lot about landscape. I know a heck of a lot about landscape, but I also know a lot about photography. And actually, I started, some of the things I was looking at originally were not landscape at all. You know, when you look through Life magazine and National Geographic, I mean, I can remember looking through back issues of Life magazine and seeing photo essays by the likes of Eugene Smith. I mean, if you've not ever seen his series of pictures that he took of the family doctor, or his Minamata pictures that he took in Japan, I mean, they're absolutely staggering. They're nothing to do with Yeah, they're to do with landscape. I mean, the family doctor is going around the village examining people and blah, blah, blah. But it's the most amazing, acute sense of observation that someone is showing you. And I think that consequently, that really sharp observation quality, you can take through to anything.
Right.
And you can learn from that to learn. I mean, the more careful you look, the better your pictures are going to be.
Absolutely.
And so if you see someone else's pictures, then I think especially if you're a landscape photographer, it's even more important not to look at other people's landscapes, because it's very, very difficult not to be influenced by them.
Hmm.
And not to go to the places that they photographed because you like the pictures. Don't go there. Go somewhere else. Go outside into your garden with the acute observation that you've picked up from somebody else's work. And that's why I absolutely love looking at a photographic work or painting that is nothing to do with landscape, that is more, I love still life, it's fantastic. You know, that there's an American photographer called Frederick Soma, who's dead for quite a while now, and he worked on 10-8 black and white negative. I first came across him because he'd done these amazing landscapes that were completely horizonless. And they were so crammed full of detail. And they might, you know, there might be a rocky hillside with some saguaro cactus covering them. And you kind of thought, my God, you know, how has he decided on where his frame should be? Because surely it could be anywhere. Because you're almost looking at like a piece of material or something.
Mm-hmm.
But no, actually, his framing is really, really tight and acute. And then I found some books of him a little later on, and he was taking photographs of bits of dissected chicken on a sort of marble slab or whatever, I'm not sure what it was, and they were even better than the landscapes. I thought, my God, this guy can do these phenomenal landscapes, and then I can see something that I never even knew he did, and they're even better. And I just love his work. I just think it's God. I mean, I could just look at it forever and ever. And it makes me want to go and not go and do pictures like him, but it makes me start thinking about subjects that maybe I haven't approached yet. And maybe I've been put off approaching because I don't think they would be of interest to me. But I look at the difference between the two things that he's done and saying, yeah, it's possible.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, that's what got me into doing my own still lives, none of which I've ever put out there. And I probably never will. But it doesn't matter. The whole process of doing them was educational and sort of affirming, really.
Totally. Well, along those same lines of inspiration, who are some photographers that you recommend that we learn more about or have here on the podcast?
I mean, I could go on forever with that, actually, Matt, from what we've just been talking about, because all of these photographers, apart from one, I mean, have you done David Ward already?
I haven't. We've chatted quite a bit, but not yet.
No, well, I mean, I think he's brilliant, David. I mean, not only is he a really, really good photographer, but he's unbelievably insightful about talking about it. Yeah. I mean, he'll be a much, much better interviewee than I am, because he's really clear. It's partly possibly because he has spent a lot of time doing workshops, and he's very, very good at talking to people and engaging with people. I'm not so good at that. So he would be one of them for sure. But the other four, or three actually, three, I mean, they're all, none of them are landscape photographers. All three of them are women. And they are all the type of photographers that I've been describing, in that I like finding someone who is way out of my genre, and finding out about them and looking at their work. And the first one is as a young woman called Sarah Mackle, who I think lives in Brooklyn, and has done an absolutely beautiful little book. Well, she's done two books now, but the first one she did was May the Road Rise Up to Meet You, which is an absolutely brilliant title, because her father was a travelling salesman of telegraph poles in America. I mean, that's a great start for a narrative already. And she followed him round for his final year when he was working, and went to all of those places that she knew nothing about. And what a boring subject selling telegraph poles must be. But she's made the most amazing book out of it. So, you know, it's a lesson to learn that one of the most boring things you could possibly imagine turns out to be one of the most interesting, because what she brought to it, and she brings in little devices and little nods to people like William Eggleston and you know, great American photographers. So that's one. The next one is a Japanese photographer called Yukari Jakura, and she produced, I think last year or the year before, the most stunning book called Zaido. And if you want to talk about production, that's about the best book I've ever seen.
Okay.
About how, I mean, it's an expensive book and it should be, because it must have cost a lot to produce. And it cost, in UK, it cost £90. So it's more than double what my two books cost. But it is the most stunning book, and I would recommend anyone to buy that book. It's fantastic. And then the third person is a Russian woman called Evgenia Abugeva, and she's done two books on the area that she comes from, which is the far north of Siberia.
Oh, wow.
And what's great about all three of those people is that they were photographing something that only they could do, because it was their backyard. You know, Sarah with her dad, Yukari Chikura was photographing this religious festival that only happens in this one place in Japan, and only she could do it because she had knowledge of it and it was her area. And again, Evgenia Abugeva, she was photographing the places that she came from. She understands them. So, you know, different to me in that the things that I've photographed on the whole aren't, none of them is to do with my backyard. You know, I was born in Hong Kong and I'm mostly photographed in this country or the States. And then I did a book on India. Well, why not?
Well, maybe... maybe you've got a Hong Kong book in your future.
I don't think so. I don't think so. It's changed so much since I was there. But yeah, maybe. I mean, who knows? I mean, it might be an interesting thing to do, to go back. I mean, right. I haven't been back for quite a long time.
Right.
But anyway, there we go.
Well, thank you, Paul. These are great recommendations. I've been trying to get David to come on the podcast for a long time. So if you have any clout or pull with him, that'd be helpful.
Well, has he been refusing you or something?
He's just busy.
Busy. Well, he is busy.
Yeah.
He is busy. I'll send him an email. I'm telling him he's got to do it.
All right.
He always does what I tell him to do.
I love
that's
it.
Absolute rubbish. That's absolute rubbish, of course. He doesn't.
Well, Paul, thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to spend this time with us here on the podcast. And lovely books. Thank you so much for sending me these. And I really do encourage our listeners to check out your books. I think even if you're not a street photographer, you're going to get something out of looking at the Indian Rights book. And of course, the landscape book is fantastic as well. So I'll put links to all that in the show notes, and hopefully we can get you a few copies of those books sold.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Yeah, thank you very much, Matt. Thank you. Been a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, thank you to Paul for joining me on the podcast this week. I had a great time speaking with you, and I wish you the best with selling copies of your new book, which I personally found to be a wonderful addition to my collection. Looking at photography from many different genres is a great way to improve your photography, so I highly recommend that listeners get a copy of the book for themselves. Before we part ways, I wanted to let you all know that I'm always looking for new ideas for podcast episodes. I want to help tell your story and showcase your work to the world. Just write to me at matt@mattpainphotography.com and use the subject podcast episode to let me know your idea. Okay, that's all for now. Thanks for stopping in, collaborating with us, and listening. See you next week.